Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. This is Admin, working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And we are, what are we up to? 46? Yeah. I think it is. So, yeah, 46. If you want to call Sweden, you have to dial 46 first. It's the atomic number of palladium. And also, all humans have 46 chromosomes, which I don't think I knew. And, of course, it's the famous number of Valentino Rossi, the most successful motorbike rider of all time. Unless, of course, you say Joey Dunlop, but that was a completely different number. And this is episode 46. It's been a couple of weeks since we last did one, so what I've been up to in the last few weeks, must have had a few things going on.
Before you start, just about the calling Sweden internationally.
Yeah.
For a while, it was actually possible to call a number, a Swedish number, and get a random Swede to talk to. So there's the swedishnumber.com, which is +46 771 793 336. You could actually call that number and get put through to a random Swede. So there you go.
Is that like what's that website you can do random video chat with? What's it called? I can't remember.
Chat roulette, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Chat roulette's the internet version of Ring in Sweden.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
So, have you been doing anything in Sweden this week?
Not me. No. I've been in Watford this week, but not quite as exciting.
Not in the Watford Gap.
No. A bit further south.
Never get out of it.
Yeah.
So I've been to an HPE now, because remember it's HP Enterprise. HP have been split into two companies. You've got HP, which is the laptops and desktops. You've got HP Enterprise, which is HPE. Their partner portal day, which basically they just tell you all about what the interesting things have come up, which is quite interesting. But can't actually say too much about that because it's all NDR stuff, because it's not out yet. They were talking a lot about containers and Docker and the future. So what I want to do is I want to talk about that a lot more after we've had a bit of introduction and stuff, and then we can kind of go into the main topic and talk about Docker and containers on Windows and Linux, or Linux and Windows even, kind of thing. Because I've been playing with both on Windows and Linux, and let's say Docker on Windows is not quite there yet. But anyway, what have you been up to, Andy?
I mean, I've had a few things which have I thought I'd bring out to the show. One of them was, the little till printers you can get. They're like Epson till printers. You just put a roll of paper in that. There's a little place that I go to, and what they actually do is they take food orders at the counter. And if there's a food order, then they send a printout to the printer in the kitchen. And then the chef takes that printout, and that's how they send the orders through in there. So the problem they had is that old Epson printer was basically knackered. It was knackered physically. It would still try and print. But you should have seen it. It was absolutely caked in grease. Like grease from chips and stuff like that. It was in all the gears. It was in all the cogs and everything. And what was actually happening, if you could imagine, it would pull the paper through, print onto it, and then there was like a cutter, like a little knife that went across on it, to cut that receipt off so they could just pull it off. So what was actually happening is that little knife blade was flicking over to cut the paper, but it was getting stuck. At nearly every time it was getting stuck. So next print that came out would get stuck underneath the blade and just roll back on itself. So we had a go at trying to clean out what we could get at, but it was just, it was no good. So they had to order a new one. And unfortunately, when the new one came through, it was exactly the same printer. But if you can imagine the interfaces on the back, the printer that they ordered, even though I told them which one to get, it had the you remember the parallel printer ports before the D-shaped 25-pin one?
Like you used to get like an HP, that HP LaserJet.
Yeah, that's right. It's like a lot bigger than a D-shaped 45-pin. And it had two springy clips on either side.
Yeah,
I think were they called Centronics?
Oh, they could have been, yeah. I'll have to look that up, actually. And it came with that connection on it, which is absolutely...
You know what? I used to have a lead that would that had the normal printer port on one end and that Centronics port on the other end.
Oh, did it, yeah.
But I chucked it out a long time ago.
Yeah, it is a Centronics. I've just looked it up, yeah. Of course, that what they needed, what the old one had, was an Ethernet port on the back of it. But this one came with the Centronics port on the back of it. So I opened up the box and saw this, and I thought, oh dear. Now, one idea, of course, but we're going to send it back. But I looked on the back of it, and where that Centronics port was, it looked like a little mountain. It looked like a little module with two screws on either side of it. And I looked on the old one, and that had a looked like a module with two screws on the either side of it. So I thought, oh, I wonder. So I unscrewed it. And then when you pull that module out, it was just the socket, a little PCB, and then a socket on the other end of it. So I thought, I wonder if we can swap the Ethernet module on the old one and swap it for this Centronics one on the new one, and then therefore it'll have the Ethernet port on it. Didn't know if it would work or not, but when I unscrewed them, the connections look exactly the same. So I think, you know, when they're manufactured in the factory, they just make every printer the same, and then they just have different models. You know, you can have a Centronics port, USB port, Ethernet port, or whatever else they want to have. So I swapped it over, and it fit straight away. I thought, well, this is good. Then put the paper in and everything. And it was even better than that, because when we went back to the actual till where they do the orders from, and then I had to go back there because I had to set up the printer from there. Now, because the MAC address, it must have been the MAC address, was obviously stored on the module that I swapped over. So when I swapped it into the new printer, I didn't have to set it up again. It had the same IP address, had the same MAC address, and it just worked straight away. So they were all made up that you didn't have to send off the send the printer off and get another one back again, because it took long enough for them to order that one, to be honest.
Did you have to solder anything?
No. It was just two screws, and then you could pull out this module, and on the back end of it, there was a PCB board and another little plug on it, like an 8-pin plug, just a square plug, or whatever pin it was. And then it just plugged in, and it looks like they've got different modules that you can just plug in to the same printer. So when they sell them, they can sell a USB version, a network version, Centronics version, you know, for whatever, you know, the customer wants to buy. But the bit that worked out even better is I thought I'd have to, you know, I didn't know what IP address it would be assigned on the network, you know, from the DHCP, whatever. But because it was the same Ethernet socket, if you like, it's exactly the same MAC address. And therefore, it remembered it as the same IP address. So then it worked. And of course, that one worked perfectly fine because it wasn't getting stuck with all the grease in it. So that was one.
When you were saying about that, I thought you were going to say you had to take it apart and soak it in acetone or something to get it working again.
That could have worked, yeah.
I'd, you could do that to the gummed up one, then you have a spare.
I certainly wouldn't eat there though. After after being there already, and funnily enough, I have.
So you wouldn't let them.
I have ate there before.
You wouldn't let them pay you in chips.
So. No. burgers and fries. Yeah, it's a little it's a little kids' play place. You know, we've all been to them, and the kids can go off and run around all like, you know, the slides and everything like that indoor. And then there's a little counter, you know, where the adults can order food or drink or snacks or whatever. That's basically what it was.
I think I don't want to cast any aspersions on your client or about the place down near here that we used to take the kids to.
Yeah.
It's sold the greasiest food that I think I've ever eaten.
Yeah. So that job that worked out really well in the end. You know, when I looked at it to begin with, I thought, oh, God, you know, come down here for nothing. But then swapping that module over sort of worked really well. Now, the second thing, we've got two more things to bring up. Now, the second thing, I'm trying to figure out how this what happened here. This wasn't a job. This was my wife's laptop. She got this old Toshiba laptop, and it was basically blue screening. And this thing that she's got is absolutely knackered. You know, the whole thing's knackered. So I said, I've got this this other HP laptop here. Said it needs a hard drive, but I can load up this for you and get that one running. So in the old laptop, it was blue screening. So I slaved it up to my computer, copied the documents over just to make sure we had everything. And then what I was going to do was put that hard drive into this other laptop, which didn't have a hard drive. This was a HP one. And I thought, I'll put it into there, I'll format it, reload everything, good to go. So I plugged it in, switched it on, and by mistake, and actually it was a good thing, by mistake, I forgot to do F12 to go to the boot menu. And it just booted from the hard drive. And then it continued to boot from the hard drive. And then, given 5 minutes, it went back to the desktop and everything was there exactly the same as it was before. So then I was thinking, hang on a minute, it was blue screening in the old laptop. I've now put it Toshiba laptop. I've now put it directly into a HP laptop and it booted up. And now I'm trying to figure out, why did it do that? And I still can't figure it out.
If it's blue screening, can't it? That be a symptom of a hardware problem? So if you swap the hard drive into a new laptop, it was some other bit of hardware that was causing.
I was okay. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. So say there was a faulty graphics card or something in the old laptop. Yeah.
Blue screening in Windows Movie means it's a memory issue.
Okay.
So it's
yeah.
probably got faulty RAM.
So if it had faulty RAM. Test,
Yeah. The easy way to test is put a Linux distro, you know, like a live CD on a USB disk or whatever, then boot it up and see if it does it the same thing.
Yeah, I could do, yeah. Well, the old laptop is completely knackered. The hinge is half gone. there's something wrong with the keyboard. You know, it's probably got flour or God knows what. So it takes it in the kitchen and those recipes with the laptop right next to it. So it could be that, yeah. So the third thing and the most exciting out the lot is I have made a real, if you like, NAS drive, effectively. What I've done is I got hold of an old... No, those tests that we're doing a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about it on the show, about running the Ubuntu server, and I was running it on a virtual machine. And we were doing all those different tests with it and everything. Well, I got a... I come across this old... I'll show you on the camera. I know no one else can see it, but... it was an old Vista eMachines mini tower, basically.
I didn't know they still made beige desktops.
Hello?
I haven't seen a beige desktop in years.
And I think this must have been... I don't know, when was Vista out? 2007 or something? So, yeah, it's about 10 years old. By no means perfect or anything like that, or set in stone. But I just thought, well, I'll install, instead of doing that on a virtual server, on a virtual machine, I'll install it on this instead. So... I actually burnt the Ubuntu distro to a DVD and loaded it off that. And all I'd done really was so loaded up the server from the DVD. And all I've done is installed the Samba's part of it. So install Samba. I had it hooked up to a monitor and a keyboard and mouse initially, or just a keyboard. I set a static IP address in the networking folder, or the interfaces file, or whatever it's called. Set that to a static IP. Then once I got the static IP, then I took the monitor and keyboard off it. So now it's just plugged in with a power and a network cable, and that's all it needs. Just like a NAS drive, really. And then I did the rest of the configuration using the SSH from the PuTTY program on a Windows machine, and then set up the Samba drive and the shared folder and the shared drive and that. Exactly the same way I've done it on the virtual machine, and it's been working really well, really. So I made up with it. The only thing that I've got to change on it is the actual network interface card built into the motherboard is 100 meg. So it's got some PCI slots in it, or PCI Express slots. And I've got a gigabit network card. But the only difference is, if you can see it on here, that the size of the PCI ports on the back, they're not the full size, you know, the mini form or whatever they call it.
Half height,
whatever. Yeah. So the network card that I happen to have is obviously a full one. And I know you only need the metal. It's only the metal plate that's different, isn't it?
So get a hacksaw to it.
I could do actually, yeah. Just cut that down and then put the gigabit into here, and then it'll just make it that little bit better. But otherwise, it works. So,
like that.
I'm not using it as an actual proper. You know, NAS drive, as you would put it. You know, I haven't set up backup on it or anything like that. I'm still using it as a test machine and just, you know, messing about with it really. It's working perfectly fine. And the only issue I've got is, you know, copying, the speed of copying, especially when I've got, you know, I've got a couple of hundred gigs of MP4 files and that I've edited. And when you copy them all over in one go, you know, it was like copying time was like 1 hour, 30 minutes or something. So
a lot of the time, those NAS drives are just little P- PCs, or they've got Linux on them, and, yeah, and they've got Samba or whatever installed on, and it's literally just Samba, you know, open source Samba and Linux kernel.
Yeah, yeah.
And if they've got RAID, they're running Linux software RAID. So, yeah.
They're getting it all for free, and they're selling it for.
It's normally done like BusyBox, isn't it? They're running a little cut down.
Yeah. So
I took a TrendNet one apart, which had two slots for two hard drives in it. But the actual like motherboard at the base of it was so small. You know, it was a bit like the size of your mobile phone. And that was the size of the PCB on the bottom of it, with two slots for SATA ports for the hard drives to slide in to the top from. And I was looking at that thinking, is that all it is? You know, it's the most minute motherboard you've ever seen in your life. A piece of plastic case for it to sit in, you know. And, I mean, this TrendNet one was about 70 or 80 quid, and I don't know how much the Synology ones are or whatever, or there's a bit more to it, but, you know, the...
But normally it's like a ARM processor is why they're it's work. So
it just doesn't need much, does it? And that's why I thought this old E-Machines, it says on the side here, you know, the specs of this is absolutely massive, isn't it? It's AMD Athlon LE processor, which I know isn't brilliant, but, you know, to run Ubuntu servers, nothing, is it? It's got a graphics card, which it doesn't even use. and it had 3 gig of memory, you know, which is massive for it. In fact, you know, when you run, what's that program called? HTOP, is it?
Yeah.
It's using the most ridiculously small amounts of memory. You know, it's got 3 gig of memory in it, and it's using, like, you know, I don't know, 50 megabytes or something, you know. So they're the main things that I've done this week. So I'll keep you posted if I do anything different on that. So what have you been up to then,
Jerry? So you've got a new Jerry job next, or something?
Yeah, started a new job. I think I may have said in previous episodes, the one that I did have, the kind of DevOpsy one that I've just had for the past year or so, came to an end. Came to the end at the end of last week. So I've actually started contracting. So I'm not actually working for this company. I'm working for my own company, and kind of that company's doing work for the company that I'm working for. But really, it's all to do with keeping HMRC happy, you know. I still have to go to work every day, so. It's interesting. It's quite different from where I have been working, where I was the only sysadmin DevOps guy, and now I am. And so, as a result, they've got lots of these different environments, kind of spread all over the place. Everything's really well documented. It's very kind of process driven, you know, they've got a process for everything. They've got project managers, and, you know, they kind of look after the techies, you know, as far as the project's concerned, but they're not particularly technical themselves. So it's quite a different environment. So, you know, that's going to take
you. Is it all projects, and is it new projects, or is it maintenance, or keeping up of current systems?
A bit of both, really. So I think I'm working on this one project, and I think, yeah, they're just kind of rolling it out at the moment. And then that'll go on to then become like a maintained project, and actually a different team deals with the support of it once it's done. So, yeah, quite a different setup from where I have been working. One weird thing is that the computer they gave me is Windows, so you've got, like, you know, but you're using all these tools like Git and Vagrant and things like that, on Windows, which is not the kind of native environment. And I've actually used Vagrant to give myself a little Linux box, basically using the VM to give me a Linux machine, so I can use Vim and Git and things like that on the command line, rather than trying to use a Windows text editor and the Windows version of Git. So that's been interesting, getting all that set up again.
So what's Vagrant?
Vagrant is it's basically a wrapper around VirtualBox, which makes it easy to spin up virtual machines.
Right.
So you get the sort of ready-made VirtualBox. They're called boxes, Vagrant boxes, and you know, so for like Ubuntu 16.04 or 14.04 or Debian Jesse or CentOS, and you just sort of say, I want a CentOS VM in a kind of configuration file, and it fires it up for you, and then you can use Ansible or Puppet or things like that to provision that Vagrant box, and put, you know, install software on it and that sort of thing. It's kind of leading on to what we're going to be talking about, Docker. It was kind of a way to have the environment set up on your laptop in exactly the same way as it would be when it was deployed. So, okay. But I think things have probably moved on a bit now to Docker and so on.
So what was the, were you talking about your the process of getting a job? Were you hanging about talking about recruiters and stuff?
Oh, yeah.
What was your experience? Maybe
as we're going to talk about Docker in this one, if there's a demand from listeners, then I can go into the whole process of, you know, actually finding a job, which is interesting. and also the whole starting up your own limited company and so on, and all the things that you have to do to get that sorted out. But yeah, it's been interesting. rather than just looking for a job, I decided to go down the route of working for my own limited company. So that's been interesting as well. Cool. But anyway, let's get on to Docker. I could do a little bonus podcast on all that, maybe.
Cool.
If anyone's interested.
Okay. I would be.
Yeah.
So I was talking about Dockers and containers. It's been quite a hot word, hasn't it, really, for the last couple of years.
It's the new hotness, as they say.
Yeah. So why use Docker? Their kind of statement is build once, run anywhere. So why would you want to use Docker? The main kind of thing is that it's basically you can ship code and applications easily from your developer's laptop to your internal infrastructure and for testing, and then, or it might be your production, or then you can put it to the cloud for deployment. And I don't know if you in the past, Jerry, if you had it in the past where you get given some code and you have to get it working in production on the server, and they give you the instructions from the developer, and it doesn't work, kind of thing, depending on dependencies. Yeah. Or in my case, in .NET kind of world, where you have to have like the www pools, .NET pools set up correctly, .dll registered correctly. But Docker solves this all by packaging all this into a Docker image. And if you have Docker installed on any machine, the Docker engine, you basically move your image, your Docker image, from one PC to another PC really easily. So it's people get confused because it's not really VMware. Sorry, it's not a hypervisor. So if I just share this to you so you can see this. Can you see that? I'll put a link in the show notes to the thing. So this is what you've got. So normally you get your server, so your physical hardware, or it can be a virtual machine. Then you get your host OS, so it might be VMware or Hyper-V or VirtualBox on Linux, which is your hypervisor. And then on top of that, you'd have your VM1 and VM2. So you've got your app A and your app B. And then you'd have your guest OS and your binaries and your libraries in one little VM. And obviously, that's quite a big footprint because you've got to have the OS for every VM. There's no kind of like deduplication of the operating system. So, but with containers, what you get is you get your physical server, then your host OS. So it can be like your, it'd be Ubuntu or Linux or Windows. And then on top of that, you have a thing called a Docker engine. And then on top of that, you'd have another thing called containers, which has basically got the binaries and the application or the files will actually need to run that application.
So it looks like, just to paint a bit of a picture for the listener, you're basically taking out the hypervisor and those multiple guest OSs that are running on top of the hypervisor, and you've just got a few layers above that to run the actual software.
Mm-hmm. So what you get is, if I go through the different bits, so you've basically got the Docker engine, which is the layer between the container and the underlying OS. It stops and starts the container, etc. It basically provides all the resources the container needs and provides like networking for it. So basically, everything, you get a Docker file. It's basically contains a number of lines of code, either config, which tells you what a Docker image consists of, like application needs like Nginx, the Nginx config files, and its web files it needs for the web app. And you basically run that Docker file with Docker engine, and it basically creates a Docker image. And that's the image you can move between hosts. And container is basically when you start a Docker image, a Docker is started in a container, and then the containers basically keep the idea that they're keeping separate. I think it's basically, if you look at the Docker icon, it's basically like it's just a shipping container, isn't it, on top of a thing. So, and the good thing about Docker is that you can more than run one Docker image on the server at once, so you can run quite multiple Dockers or containers on one host. So it's a lot. Let's talk about hype in virtualization. You can get about a 40% 40% utilization on the server, but because basically you want to have the overhead. So if you've got like three clusters, three Hyper-V hosts or very virtual box virtual servers, or sorry, physical virtual servers, if you get the hypervisors, the virtual controllers, no, that's wrong, the kind of the things that host the virtual machines,
the physical hosts,
yeah, the physical hosts, the hypervisors, you basically have like three of them in a cluster, so that if one goes down, they the other ones take up the load, so you can't fully put them up to 100% because of it will. If you lose one of your hosts, then you're going to be stuffed because you've got nothing for your workload. But with Docker, the idea is that it grows and shrinks with your workload. You can configure it to. So if you think about it, if you have like a load balancer and virtual and containers behind it, you can get a greater consolidation rate on your host. Because it doesn't really matter if you lose one of your hosts, because the other servers will pick up the load, because this is all about kind of like containers are more like they're not like going to replace your file servers or your Exchange servers. It's about running web apps, isn't it?
And it's about running stateless things mostly as well. You can run stateful things, but a stateless thing. I mean, if you think of a web server as just like something where your web requests go and then you get a response, that's stateless. It doesn't need the kind of clockwork moving underneath it. It can just point it at it and then get a response back.
So also with more of a thing is it's more about scale out, not up. So like if you've got your application is like scaled, is scale out, not up. So if you've got an application, and the more users you get, you've got to give the server more and more memory and more RAM. That's basically scaling up.
Or is it?
Where scaling out is means that you can do space. Yeah. Is you just give it more, just give it more Docker instances and put it behind a load balancer kind of thing. I'll put a link in the show notes to a couple of YouTube videos what really explain this a lot better than what I'm explaining now. But all the like how like things like Spotify use Dockers for their work. And there's people who will say that every Google search you do is in a Docker, is in a container. Yeah,
that's the thing actually. Google have been using containers for probably 10 years now. And so they never went to VMs. So if you think of AWS, is basically a massive VM farm. You can get physical hosts as well, I think. But yeah, Google's data centers have been running containers for since, you know, pretty much since they started, I think. So, and that they've actually, there's a container scheduling engine, which maybe we'll get onto that later, called Kubernetes, which is actually from Google. And it's probably, you know, a very cut down version of what they use in their massive.
Because containers stuff have been about for a long time, haven't they? Basically, it's just how it fully works, but basically you've got your kernel, and that the containers on top of it can speak to the underlying kernel, can't it?
Maybe a useful way. Maybe some listeners have heard of Cheroot, which is I think I've explained this previously, but a Cheroot is basically a folder on the file system, and you think of the Linux file system, you've got etc and bin and all that. A Cheroot is just a subdirectory with all those directories in it. And there's a special command Cheroot where you say Cheroot into this directory, and then you're in this Cheroot, and it looks like just a Linux machine, but it's actually just a subdirectory. So all containers are really is just that, but with a networking element as well. So everything's still running on the physical host or the VM that you're running on, but it thinks it's running on a whole separate system.
Yeah. So it's quite good. So yeah, and the other thing you get is you can call repositories, where basically the idea is that you get so if you're a developer, I make my little web app, Nginx, put my little web files in it, combined it in my little, to create my Docker file, put it into a little container, run it on my little machine, and then you push it to either into a terminal repository or you push it to Docker's, I think it's called Hub or something, and then you basically from running from production servers, you can say get the image and it basically downloads it, or if you're in Azure or AWS or DigitalOcean, you can then basically pull it in to your machine. So,
another quite clever thing that it does is you can say that, right, I've got my, you know, say this is Owl's image, but it's made up of all these other images. So, you know, you can get an Nginx image, a MySQL image, say, and it will join those together. And all they are is like diffs of each other. So, it's like a layer. It will layer the MySQL bit on top of the Nginx bit to give Owl's container, and that's a kind of part of the way Docker is different from sort of standard containers.
And that's so Docker's quite cool. Very cool, in fact. I mean, I'm going to show you a little demo, I think, for us to have a look. And I'll basically put the video up onto YouTube so you guys can watch it. So basically, in DigitalOcean, I basically created a little Doppler, and it's basically got Docker installed already. So what I'll do is So can you see my screens then, guys?
Yep.
Yeah, we can, yeah.
So what we can do is really easily. So basically, I'm just basically SSH into my Ubuntu, but especially Ubuntu 14.04 or 16.04 with Docker installed. I'm really amazed how quickly you can create a server on DigitalOcean and it's just there to be used, kind of thing. And it takes about 55 seconds to boot.
Yeah, I did that the other day. Actually, it's brilliant, isn't it?
I mean, it's like 0.007 cents an hour. So I was like showing the guys in the office how to use it. And it was like, what's this? So what you've got is, so basically you can run a command. I've got it up here. So basically SSH. And basically you basically type things. You basically take Docker, if I get anything. So Docker space run. And you basically, you give it a name. So I'm gonna call this is web one. And is it back, what do they call that with like that? Is that I never remember what it's called, where hyphen B kind of thing? Is that what they call it? Hyphen kind of thing? Hyphen D? That means basically
is that,
like on the
that's a switch, I think they call.
So switch D, which basically is D, means it runs as a daemon. And then a P, which means basically what port it runs on. So basically with Docker, when you run an application, like this is an Nginx thing I'm giving you, it basically, it will bind the port number to its own little local host, but that's not presentable to the internet or to the Docker's or the host's IP address, if that makes sense.
It's effectively like a router at home, as if you're port forwarding on your router at home.
So you basically, it's just NATing it internally. So basically, you type in 808.8081 or 8080, I'm going to put it on first, and then put it on to 80. So it's basically the little container's told that it's going to be publishing its web server on 80, but I'm telling it to publish it to my public IP address on 8080 of the DigitalOcean. And then you basically just do, is it tum, and then go / hello world, which is basically just like a little web server displaying hello world. And basically, because that's not installed locally on my machine, it basically goes to Docker and says, I want you to download this hello world image. And it should download it and put it on the machine. It says it can't find it.
So it's pulling those layers down. That image is made up of all those layers.
So yeah, what happens, it tried to do it locally, can't find it, goes off to the Docker repository and brings down five little things. So now if I do in my little thing go Docker space PS minus A, it basically shows me what Docker processes are running. So it tells me that I'm running one little world, hello world command. So on this, I think it is my IP address for this thing, so copy that, bring up a new browser and go to 8088, and there's my hello world. And you see this host name here matches what it is. So now what I can do is I go up again twice, I can then run that again, another instance of that thing, but I'm changing the port, because you can't have the same port on before. So I'm now changing the port 8081. So I'm basically running Docker run again, naming, and going to call this name web 2, return, and you can see it's down, literally just really quick, it downloaded that up again. So if I now
actually cached that, because it's pulled all those layers down, it's cached that somewhere, so it knows that you want exactly the same thing. So it's just grabbed all that data and it's put it in another container without having to go out to the internet.
So now if I put in the IP address and then port 8081, I get back another hello world with a different host name, which is really cool. So I'm basically just running, within 2 minutes, running two hello worlds. This is just really cool. So if I do a Docker run PSA, it will show me those two things. And then to kill them, I can remove them really quick as well. So I can go Docker RM, the name of them. So I've got, I think I called one web minus F to force it and removes it. And then web 2 removes it again. So if I do PSIM again, they've got no Dockers running on my machine at all. And now they've gone completely. So that's how quickly you can then import two Hello Worlds on a DigitalOcean box, which is really good. And that, and that's good. But the even cleverer thing is, if I run this command again, but a slightly different command this time. This time I'm going to, yeah. This time it's going to run two Hello Worlds again. So I basically created two Hello Worlds again, Web 1 and Web 2. And then you can download a little thing called HA Proxy, which is a load balancer. And what this does, so in this command, I've got docker space run hyphen D hyphen P port 8080, and then linking Web 1 and Web 1, and then linking Web 2 and Web 2 to my little load balancer. Click on return. If it can't find it locally, it then downloads them. So now I should have, once it's downloaded, I should have three little Docker images running on my machine. So I've got two little Docker images running Hello World with a load balancer in front of it. So if I go Docker PSIA minus A, I should have three little things now running my little Docker. So now if I just basically put in the IP address of the web server, it was my Docker instance, or sorry, my instance of DigitalOcean. If I just refresh this, I should get, if you can see that the host name keeps changing, so it's load balancing between the two.
Yeah.
How cool is that? I mean, that's just like, if you watch that, I put it on YouTube kind of thing, I've had it, and it just shows you how powerful those, how Docker is. So, if you say, if you're on your machine, your laptop, make your image, your Docker image, put it into a, then you can push that to your repository, and then you can pull it down onto any machine which has got Docker installed in it. So I'll just quickly just kill both of those, and then we can talk about, does it all make sense kind of thing, showing a little demo like that kind of thing.
That's probably the easiest I've seen now, because I've played around with Docker quite a lot, but and actually used it. I haven't used it in production, but I've used it at work for other things. And that's probably one of the easiest demos I've seen of it.
I just love how you can just, DigitalOcean is just so cool. You can, and I don't know how much it's going to cost me to run that for a little while. So I'll shut this down, and then we can go back to where we were. Shut down. Right. It should be, yeah, so that's that. Right, so that was Docker on Linux. Let's talk about Docker on Windows. So Windows containers work the same way as Linux containers. Each centralized application runs in its own little user mode, isolated container on a shared host operating system. There are two types of containers in Windows. You get Windows container, which just works like Docker containers. But then you get a thing called Hyper-V containers, and these are something different. These are, there are two challenges with the approach that may cause a problem in certain environments. Not enough isolation, since the isolation is that the user mode means a shared kernel. In a single-tenant environment, which applications can be trusted that they're not a problem, but in a multi-tenant environment, it's a bad idea to use a shared kernel attack one each other's container. There's a dependency on how the host OS version and even patch level may cause problems as a patch is deployed on the host, which breaks the application. This is where Hyper-V containers can be used. Hyper-V containers use a base image defined for application automation, creating Hyper-V VM that uses a base image, and inside that VM are various binaries, libraries, and applications inside the Windows container. And it is a critical point, Hyper-V containers are still using Windows containers within VM. The only difference is the Windows containers is now running inside a Hyper-V VM, which provides kernel isolation and is separate of the host patching version level from the used by application. The application is centralized using Windows containers, and There's a deployment time. You pick the level of isolation required by choosing a window or Hyper-V container. This is shown below. So here's a little icon. I'll put the icon in the show notes. So basically, you've got two little things where you've got the host kernel, the user mode, the binary, and you've got little controller apps in the little thing. And then Hyper-V container is basically, you're basically doing nesting hypervisor. So you've basically got your hypervisor, and then you're nesting in that another little kernel, which is a nano server. And on top of that, you can have the containers.
So it sounds like you would always want to use a Hyper-V VM container if you were running it on the internet, you know, if you...
Only if I think they're only saying if you're using shared, so if you've got like a multi-tenancy thing, if you haven't got that need, then you can run it in it. I think that's being super secure, because I was reading, I'll put a link in the show notes as well, but there's like a video I was watching where the guy was telling you how they basically had to, because obviously Linux kernel is open source and everyone can look at it, whereas there's like certain ways like you can't call certain things. Mm. And this is the way they had to like kind of get a way around it to kind of make it work like Docker. So I've been playing about with this today on my Windows 2016. So I downloaded 2016 TP5, which is basically the technical preview file, which is basically the last version before they're going to release it. They haven't actually given a release date of 2016. That's Windows Server. But basically Ignite, which is basically the big Microsoft thing every year, is at the end of the month, the end of September, and that's when they're going to probably expect to basically release it. And what it is that you basically install containers. So you basically install Windows 2016, install containers as a role, and then you install Docker on top of it. And then I was running all those Docker commands, you can run exactly the same Docker commands in a Windows box.
Using the Docker software, but you have to run Windows containers with Docker. Okay.
So
I didn't know that. I thought that they had their own containerization software. But
I think they have, but Docker is the way you manage it. So you can do the Docker push pull.
Yeah.
So this is quite a good example. There's a little picture I put on the show notes as well. It says, there will be no cross-platform containerization. So since Docker library, LCS are not hypervisors and containers are not VMs, there is no currently way to present the appropriate kernels to the containers from a different platform. Windows containers will require Windows Docker host and Linux containers will require Linux Docker host. The Windows Server containers reuse the host kernel and create a sandbox environment for the process exactly like it does in Linux. And thus there is unlikely fundamental change in the way both platforms work, either having a common kernel, cross-platform certification, and simply being a thing. There's a big picture with the guy, is it Gandalf from Lord of the Rings, saying, "You shall not get cross-platform containers." But we might do one day. That's maybe why we've basically been putting the Ubuntu Bash is now on Windows 10, isn't it?
Put a Linux Hyper-V VM on Windows and run Docker in that VM, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Nothing's stopping you from doing that.
No. So there's two ways to manage containers in Windows. Windows containers can be created and managed through either Docker or PowerShell. Containers created with PowerShell cannot be currently managed by Docker and vice versa. You basically get this thing called Nano Server. It's basically a stripped down version of Windows Server 2016, optimized for running containers. Basically, you've got no GUI, you can't run file shares on it, you can't be a domain controller or anything. And it's a bit like the Ubuntu Snappy kind of thing. And you basically have to rerun PowerShell to control it kind of thing. But I was reading online, and apparently you can only get Nano Servers. It hasn't been confirmed yet, but it's basically the licensing is that you have to have an agreement with Microsoft to use it. So you can buy the software from Microsoft, then you have a agreement with them. So if a new version comes out, you get a newer version, like software assurance. You can only have the Nano server when you do it. But I had problems today with Nano with running this container software in Windows. So basically, I've got a, at work, we've got a VMware cluster, which you basically is our demo environment. It's basically just a load of hosts and a load of storage, which you can best play with stuff, which is really cool. So I put 2016 on it, because obviously you can download it. Anyone wants to download it, you can download it for 90 days for free to have a play with it. And you install everything, got Docker installed. But when you try to start Docker D, which is basically just talking Docker as a daemon, or you start at the servers, it's moaning about the networking. And I thought it was because it's like, hang on a minute, am I maybe the double nesting hypervisors? But apparently there's a bug. Hopefully they fix it in the actual release version. But it can't create a NAT network. And you know, like I was showing you how you map it to like 8080 to port 80.
Yeah.
Oddly, when I was doing that on the command line in, I'm actually going to put a blog post on the post on our website about this, because Googling it, I couldn't find out anything else. I found a couple of people else moaning about it, and that I kind of hacked it together. So I basically managed to write, you basically have to create a bridge network, a NAT network. And when you basically do that, you can start Docker. But when you basically say that thing where you map it to yourself, like port 8080 to port 80, that wasn't working. So I need to look into work that. But because I had NAT, so if you're from an external machine and you put the IP address of the 2016 server, it wouldn't work. But if you actually RDP onto that server, and because it had the bridge network into the NAT network, and you type the actual IP address of the container, it worked. You could get to the actual Docker instance. So, and the only other thing about it is that, you know, like you were talking about how it downloaded those four other items on that thing, the dependencies, yeah. So like Nginx probably. Yeah. Well, in Windows, you basically have to download the server core. So I was basically running RIS, which is like the web server for Windows, like you get Apache or Nginx for Linux. Yeah. You get the RIS for Windows. Before you can do that, you have to download a 4 gig file container. And we're not even sure how quickly I'd got that. That was literally, that box I got was doing a demo earlier. It was literally an image created from whatever it's called, DigitalOcean.
Yeah.
And then you saw me download those images to get Nginx working, little Hello World, in like 2-4 minutes or whatever it downloaded it and did it.
Yeah.
Whereas you have to do it with Linux. With Windows, you've got to download a 4 gig file and then another thing. Okay, maybe you only have to, on that host you're loading up when you put it into production, you have to do it once, but it doesn't seem to be there yet on Windows. I think they got the idea of that.
I mean, they announced it probably, it was when we were at OddCamp, so that was about a year ago, wasn't it? I think they'd announced it shortly before that, but looks like they're having a bit of trouble getting it to work, maybe.
Yeah, but people are using it and stuff, and yeah, so the idea is there, but hopefully they get it when they release it at scale, build at the end of the month.
I've got a feeling that Docker might be just a bit too established now on Linux for them to challenge it, but competition's always good, I'd say.
But it's good though that you can do the same core thing where you can do that kind of thing. Like you can just do it. Good how they want to do the idea where you do the same sort of thing in Windows, where you package it and then you can push it up to the cloud or whatever, and then you can kind of
write once, run anywhere, basically. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is good.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of. I think there's a lot of people. Implementing Docker like that. It's basically so developers can do what they do and not have to worry about getting that, what they've done, into production. Yeah, and there's all sorts of interesting challenges about how you manage these containers as well, which I haven't worked on any of these container scheduling things, but maybe I will in the future. I can report back on that.
But no, it's good though, isn't it? I mean, I'll put a link in the show to the other Spotify thing where it shows you how they kind of do it, if you know, how they kind of how they use Docker. There's definitely lots of different things. I'll put a link in the show notes as well to like a series of one where a guy shows you how he basically develops a test environment and puts it in production, how he scales up using, is it CoreOS or something? I haven't played with it, but
yeah. So CoreOS is just a very stripped down Linux distribution, which is basically designed to run containers. So, like you're saying, Nano Server is slightly similar to that. I've got a couple of links which I'll put in the show notes as well, just talking a bit about the history of containers, because containers have been around for quite a while. I think LXC is the underlying technology, and that's been around, you know, obviously before Docker. So there's some history there. And there's also a blog post which someone new to containers is more asking questions about, you know, how it all works than...
So at the start of the week, I knew nothing about containers and Dockers, and at the end of the week, I know quite a bit about it. So
it's interesting. And the way that it just works, like you said, is quite appealing.
And I was, it's just good.
One of the things to bring up about this, though, is the security aspect, because you showed how easy it was to download, an image, you've got to be aware of what's contained in that image. So that was always the bit where when I've played with Docker, that's what I've come up against, is how do you know where that image came from? How do you know that the image is secure? How do you know it doesn't contain malware or something like that? So there's
a lot of them you can kind of sign with keys and stuff. The guy was saying, so you can basically put it into your repository, and if you ever got the keys, you know it's kind of secure kind of thing. So you build it up from scratch kind of things.
But
I'm still a bit worried about how do you update it kind of thing. But then again, it comes down to this kettle and pet thing, where you basically, if there's a new security update, you go along to your server, or your developer updates his image, and then he puts that image to the cloud, and you destroy everything else, and you just build everything up from the new images or whatever.
And there's also, if you run an SSH server in that container, there's nothing stopping you from SSHing in and doing it like that. So say, here's my mention of Ansible for this episode, you're using Ansible to go in and do the updates inside the container. Or do that on your laptop and then build the image and deploy that image. One other thing to mention about Docker is, that favourite, the laptop of choice for a lot of developers is a Mac. And Mac doesn't run Linux, so it doesn't actually run containers natively. So to run Docker, you have to run... in most cases, VirtualBox, and then run Docker inside a VM. So it's still, that's a problem to be solved as well. Running Docker on a Mac.
Yeah, you have to run anything called Docker to boot or boot to Docker or something. Bootload.
Which is basically, I think, as I understand it, that's just using a VagrantBox to run Docker. If you've got a Linux laptop, then you're sorted. But if you've got a Mac, like most people have, that are working in this sort of area, you can't do it natively at the moment. So that's another thing to be aware of.
Cool. Okay. Well, I don't think I've got any more to say about Docker.
I'm sure you sound like you're quite excited about it. So. I expect to hear more in future podcasts.
I think so. Well, basically, I went to this HPE thing and they were talking about Docker because they apparently they're kind of like the only people who have got certified with Docker and embedded Docker kind of thing that they can run their kit on kind of thing. And the guy didn't really do a very good share about it, but I wanted to know about it because actually a week before my other guy was saying, have you heard anything about Docker? And my office, I went, yeah, I was one of it. And then my boss goes, I want to know about Docker because we might be able to kind of like, sell these kind of things. So, oddly, apparently DigitalOcean have got a problem because I can't get to my DigitalOcean thing to turn it off kind of thing. So, but you know, the DigitalOcean status Twitter account apparently, 42nd, 6th, our team investigating connect the origin to our website and cloud platform. So yeah, you can have a bit of a follow.
You've broken okay. it. You've broken it with your Deco Domo.
So,
you've broken the whole thing.
I've broken the internet. That black box from on the IT crowd.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, well, I think I haven't got anything to say. Anything else to say, guys?
I'd completely forgot about something that I was going to add before. Just something else that I did to the little Ubuntu server that I made. Has anyone here used or heard of a Plex server?
Yep, running it.
Yeah, Plex server. They use it.
Me too.
On, Xboxes, I think, use it mostly. So one thing I sort of have a play about with is I've got all the stuff that I've edited and stuff like that, and I copied it onto the NAS drive that I made. Now I've put a link into the notes, which takes you to a website, which actually is the full instructions of installing Ubuntu server onto a computer, installing the Plex server where you can download it from. So once you've got Ubuntu server on your machine, or I suppose you can do it with just a normal Ubuntu or any Linux, I suppose, can't you? But it says that you go to the download page, you have to copy the get the latest image using wget to download. It's a Debian package, you think it is, .deb file. You download that into the /temp directory. Then there's all instructions. You'd have to look on the show notes to get the proper instructions in that. And then once it's installed onto that, you can then go back to your any computer web browser. You go to the IP address of the server that you've made, and then colon to ports 32400/web. And then that takes you then to a web interface at the Plex server. Then you can add your libraries and stuff like that, and do that from a web interface. So I tried all that, and I've done it all, and I've managed to stream all the videos, or music, or pictures, or whatever you want to do, through our Xbox. So it worked really well. Now, whether you're a big fan of Plex or you like how it works or you don't, I'm sure there are other very similar services out there. But I tried it and it worked really well.
You can also use it on a Chromecast and use your phone to control like you do with
yes,
the Chromecast.
Yes, you can, yeah. Yeah, I've put the Plex thing on my phone so you can do things like play, pause, you know, skip ahead and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
From your phone app.
I like how you can go from one device to another, so you can watch it on the TV or watching it from your phone, and it picks up from where you go.
That's right, yeah.
And how it does, like, the antenna, is it the antenna, or like the way it knows what the does a picture of it and stuff,
kind of thing.
So, it's also just, I like the new Amazon. You got, do you use Amazon Prime, whatever, or Amazon Video kind of thing? Have you watched that where it's got its X-ray thing in it, so that basically it, when it watches a video, it tells you what the music in the background is, and it also tells you who the players, who the actors are. Kind of thing.
Yeah, right. So. I'm waiting to get a telly with Amazon Prime on it. I've had Amazon Prime for the past, since Christmas, pretty much, but I haven't had a telly that I could watch it on, and I wasn't going to get another Amazon Fire Stick or whatever they're called, because A, I haven't got enough HDMI ports in my telly, and B, I don't want something else hanging out the back of my telly. Is waiting to get.
Have we got today one? Have you been watching Mr. Robot as well? Or not?
I've only seen the first few episodes. I'm saving them up. Yeah.
I want to see all of them. I haven't started yet, but I know they sound pretty good.
Yeah. Cool.
So I'm going.
Also, what about that thing? Go on, go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah. What was I going to? Oh yeah. No. The Have any of you two got Sky TV?
No, I got Now TV. Shows all the Sky stuff.
Well, Sky TV's got an app, and then you can do the same with that. You know, you can go to your planner and press play and pause and all of that from your phone app. You know, it's like a remote control for your TV through a phone app as well. It's kind of fun when people don't know you've got it, and you pause the video that we're watching. And they're like, press and play again, and then you keep pausing it.
So what were you going to say, Al?
So,
I was going to say that thing I listened to latest Ubuntu podcast, and I talk about that Raspberry Pi uses of having it so that it's got attached to a screen, and then you can send, like, have it as a
picture frame, was it?
Digital
photo.
Yeah, and you basically just send your picture. Oh, that sounds a really good idea. Yeah. I need to ask.
Yeah, that sounded good, didn't it? Sounds like you can get a kit to do it.
Yes.
That's on one of the recent ones, is it?
The last one.
All right. I'm too behind on them, so I'll catch up.
I'll just have a look at my invoice. Apparently, it cost me 0.01. Is that 1 cent it cost me to run that Docker for an hour?
Oh, there's another thing that I just remember to bring up as well. I don't know if you've noticed this, but we had an email, didn't we?
What about from a sponsor or something?
No, it wasn't that. It was an email. Let me find it. It was an email to do with something Jerry brought up in the last episode.
It was David Apps, wasn't it? I remember.
To do with, that's it. To do with a podcast that you were a BBC episode.
All right.
I must have missed that.
Yeah, I've got it up now, just found it. It's from David Apps, so all he said was, thank you for such an informative and enjoyable podcast. In episode 45, Jerry was referring to a BBC programme that was about Fortran. Well, that's that thing I was bringing up about Fortran. Yeah. I think the programme was probably the programme, and then he's put a link to it. Which we'll put in the show notes. And it's BBC 4, Radio 4, and the program is called Codes That Change the World. And there's 5 episodes that you can download or probably put into your podcatcher or listen online.
Yeah, I listen to them as a podcast, yeah.
Yeah, they were last broadcast in April 2015.
Cool, was it that long ago?
But yeah, so is that the one you were talking about, was it?
Yeah. There's one about Fortran.
Yeah, so he obviously...
And then the next one's about COBOL.
Oh, wow, okay.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realise that. I missed that email completely. I must have saw that as cool. Thank you for the email. I like emails coming in.
Yeah, that was a good one, yeah. He obviously listened to what you were... You know, because you couldn't remember at the time, could you? Or you were trying to think of something.
Yeah, I couldn't remember.
And he probably
went,
I know the one. He probably thought, I know the one. Found it online and sent us an email with the link on.
Yeah.
So we can put that link in the show notes as well if anyone wants to listen to it. So there'll be five good episodes that people can listen to.
So like Fortran is episode 1, COBOL is episode 2, BASIC is episode 3, and then it's got, I think it's got functional... Java is episode 4, and then it's the Tower of Babel, which is I can't remember what that's about.
Wow, thank you very much for emailing in. So
it says, so episode 5, they explore how today's digital world is a reverse Tower of Babel. I don't even know what that means. Is that some kind of cryptic thing?
Tower of Babel was in the Bible.
A reverse Tower of Babel.
Yeah, so what was it? Everyone spoke the same language, and they tried to build a tower because they thought that they were better than God. But God punished them by destroying the tower and making everyone speak different languages. So that was nice of him, wasn't it?
So what are they trying to do, make everyone talk the same
language? I think what it's saying is, it says... today's digital world is a reverse Tower of Babel. It takes all sorts of different languages to build it. So, yeah, it's basically talking about how it's gone from, like, one or two languages in the old days to, thousands today.
Yeah. It kind of makes things difficult for us, doesn't it? You know, you've got to learn Fortran and C and Basic and Java. And so,
cool. Right, guys, that's it. Remember, social websites on our social, whatever, on our...
You can even put some of the links we've mentioned, you know your YouTube video. We could put a link to that BBC page on the social media as well as the show notes.
Yeah, we need to get more active, get more people. We're going to... Yeah. Well, that's what I'm going to do is host this post to my Google, my issue. I couldn't get the Hyper-V stick or the container thing working Windows. When you Google it, nothing really came up, so I'm hoping we can get to the top of that and we'll be all right. Okay, well, we'll speak to everyone soon, and bye for now.
See you later. Bye now.